Blog Talk Radio.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and welcome to our broadcast, formerly called The Socialist Insight, now Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. And I'm Stuart Alexander, joining you today to discuss many of the important issues that are facing working people, facing the left within this country, and issues that many of us should be concerned about daily, because it, not only does it affect our lives, our day-to-day living, but also it affects the future of generations to come. And today we have Al Suarez. He's joining our program once again. He'll be joining us as a regular. And Al, thanks again for joining the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here for the first episode of The Left Turn, right, the new name.
Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. And Al, you know, you bring to the table a lot of information that people on the left should be aware of. We're living in some treacherous times, and the reason why I say treacherous times is it's gotten to the point here in this country that many people can't even trust the government that are supposed to be there, has been installed for our national and international well-being. And now people like yourself, you can come to our listeners and explain things that people see beyond the news media that they see at 6:30, that they see first thing in the morning, which basically is just entertainment news. And today what we're discussing with Al is the international lawless community, international lawless community. Now, Al, we have hot spots all around the world, and many of us still think that we have bodies in place such as the Hague Court. We have bodies in place such as the United Nations, and we have bodies in place which is the Congress of the United States and other countries that we put trust and faith in, such as Great Britain, such as Germany. But now we see that we're living in a global community, and many of these players in this global community, they're doing things that's creating shock across the world. We hear on a regular basis about the war on terror, but it really appears now is not a war on terror, but it's really a war on working people for the international global financial community. So
now
what
I wanted
to start... War of Terror, you're correct. So, Al, what I'm going to do, I want to focus, first of all, some of the hot spots that it's many hot spots. I could go on and on and on. But let's start with some of the things that we hear that is starting to creep up in the news on a daily basis. If you go back to 2003, we entered that war in Iraq. Supposedly, there were weapons of mass destruction. There was a terrorist regime. They were training terrorists to send throughout the world, and we saw that all that was a lie. And then, Al, we sent our troops over, and we lost approximately close to 5,000 troops fighting in those bloody wars that were all based on a lie, Al. They were based on a lie. This president came in, and he said within 9 months of me being in office, he said, if I don't have the troops out in the first 9 months in office, he said, there will be no second term. But, Al, we can see that was another lie. But, Al, what I want to focus on today, now we see ourselves entering into another conflict there in Iraq. When we thought that we were all done with Iraq, here at the end of his second term, we are being launched by this president and committing troops in Iraq. What are your ideas on us sending troops and getting engaged in a war in Iraq once again?
Well, first of all, you know, the United States did not withdraw from Iraq until 2012, so it was long after 9 months. And secondly, even after the U.S. troops left, there was, contractors that stayed behind, mercenaries pretty much.
Mercenaries.
Right, because the largest military base, or one of the largest U.S. military bases, is in Baghdad, so they weren't going to leave that empty. So, you know, of course, the United States supported ISIS.
And the largest embassy and the largest U.S. embassy in the world right there in
Baghdad. Oh, I didn't know
Baghdad.
That about the embassy, and they sent just, what, another
300? The largest in the world.
Let's call them what they are, troops. They sent another 300
right.
troops into Iraq to defend the embassy, supposedly. You know, God knows where else these troops are going. And these are not advisors. These are not trainers. They're troops, and they're wearing boots, so they are boots on the ground. That's another line. There's not going to be any boots on the
right.
ground. I mean, it's not as big amount as it was in 03, but it's still, you know, an amount of soldiers that they're sending there. And they're doing more than just guarding buildings, trust me. And, you know, you've had instances where, I don't remember what they're called now, but, you know, Blackwater, former Blackwater, they're pretty much
right.
the same guys, the mercenaries, Blackwaters. You know, they've been in Iraq, and they've committed atrocities. And they're not only in Iraq. They've captured American citizens that were part of these mercenary groups in Ukraine. Fighting
right.
Eastern Ukrainians. So it's not just a question of, you know, is the United States funding or training fascists in Kiev, but they've literally sent Blackwater guys, mercenaries, into Ukraine. You know, and of course the United States supported ISIS. They do have Iraqi origins, but they supported him in toppling the Mossad.
Right.
So, you know, the United States has shown time and time again that they're willing to support anybody against their enemies. Whether they're terrorists or fascists or whatever. And you mentioned The Hague earlier. When I first took an interest in politics in high school, I joined up with the Model UN, and I became less naive and realized about the Security Council and how they veto world consensus, these five powers, you know, China, Russia, France, Britain, and the United States, that they have all the power to veto what the rest of the world wants in the UN since the end of World War II. So, you know, will you ever see any leaders from the five Security Council countries brought to the International Criminal Court of The Hague? I doubt that. I was living outside the country when the protests were going on against the Iraq intervention, although I have family members that took part in it. But I did, my first protest was in 2001. Against the intervention in Afghanistan. And we already knew about the pipelines then. And then we hear about the poppy fields and all these other things, you know, the real reason behind the empire's intervention in Afghanistan. And, you know, the UN is supposed to be a legislative body. Well, the overwhelming
right.
majority of the world votes on something such as the two-state solution, Israel-Palestine. You know, this is the United States, Israel, and, I don't know, Dominica, some island in the Caribbean that votes against the other world. Votes the other side, but, you know, they're vetoed by the United States, who's, you know, protecting the Israeli interests over the interests of their own people.
Right. Well, we can see back in 2003 that we started out where we were sending troops putting troops on the ground. But what I see more recently, we're starting out with 300 troops and people such as myself, and this was before you were born, Al, we saw the same thing with Vietnam. They were sending troops and advisors to Vietnam. President
yep.
Johnson, he sent 300, and next thing, we had close to a half a million American young men and women committed to that war, 58,000 deaths. Same thing here. It's almost like there was just a pause, but now we're committing troops back into that area of Iraq. Basically, we install a criminal regime. I mean, basically, that government, ever since Saddam Hussein was ousted out, it has been nothing short of a terrorist community as far as civil liberties, the rights of the community, voting. We can see it's a lot of fraud in the voting. It's basically what we have installed. just like we have installed the more recent government there. Well, not we, but the Western countries installing that government there in Ukraine. But back to what I was saying, they start out with advisors that they had sent to Vietnam. Now here we're sending troops. They just sent additional troops to Iraq, which now they have approximately 600 troops that have been sent to that area. But we can see there's a pattern. Instead of letting those people solve their issues, I shouldn't say solve their issues, Al, because we actually created the problems that they got. But here's a government that is not even capable of
sandals.
Pardon me?
My friend said the other day, why don't they just send the troops with sandals? That way they can say, you see, there's no boots on the ground.
but they have supposedly trained an army, just like they did in Vietnam, that was ill-equipped, ill-trained. But we started out from the premises from where we started was wrong from the beginning. We should not have been involved. We should have had all the facts together. But as you know myself, I'm against war. I'm for peace. But if there is to be any cause for war, let's not fabricate that cause. But as I had mentioned, Al, there in Iraq, we are following a path that we saw 11 years ago. And this has already cost the American people more than $3 trillion. $3 trillion. And it's still the cost is still climbing. Pardon me?
Just a portion of that amount could have eradicated poverty in the country for a whole generation. Think about all the resources that were wasted. And speaking of poverty, a lot of people say, well, in Vietnam they had the draft. It's not as bad now. It's like, excuse me, have you ever heard of the economic draft? I mean, you have kids living in the ghettos, and they literally have to decide between a $50,000 salary and join the military or selling drugs. You know, that's really the choice
And we can see that more than 2,000 years ago. Were you going to fight for the armies of Rome, or were you going to live in poverty? The choice was, well, I'll fight. I'll be in the army because at least my family will be taken care of and I'll be taken care of. So, Al, the question I have is, do we have, under any circumstances, do we really have a reason that we should be re-entering that country and getting involved, even with this new threat that is there in Iraq? And then I want to ask you also about that threat, because, again, I believe that the U.S. is behind that. I don't have all the facts to prove it, but I do believe it's there. But do you think we should be re-entering that country militarily?
Well, we do have some facts to back up what we're saying. For example, ISIS lost in Syria. Let's face it, you know, Assad just had very successful elections, and he's still in power. So ISIS said, okay, we can't topple Assad. Let's go get this other Shia guy, Maliki, in Iraq. And we do have evidence to back up, for example, the fact that the rebels in Syria had chemical weapons. They were caught at the border of Turkey with chemical weapons in their hand. Okay, you don't have to be a rocket scientist.
Who is that again?
The rebel groups that were fighting Assad were caught on the border with Turkey multiple times with chemical weapons, and they were turned away because they had chemical weapons on them. That's a fact.
Right.
And Turkey is a supporter of the rebels, so why would Turkey lie about that? I mean, it's a fact. They were caught on the border with chemical weapons. There's never been any evidence that Assad used chemical weapons, but we have plenty that the rebels had them. I said used, not had, okay? We know Assad had the chemical weapons. Obviously, he's given up his chemical arsenal. And in the process, the rebels had tried to acquire those weapons while they were disassembling them. But, you know, if you say, you know, the rebels had chemical weapons, they probably did it, and the United States probably gave it to them. There are some facts that can back that up. You know, if you look at the history, Saddam Hussein was a client of the United States for a while, and he got chemical weapons. And if he continued to get chemical weapons even after he defeated the Iranians and used them against the Kurds, the United States, was trying to conquer and divide and encourage the Kurds to uprise. And then the United States betrayed the Kurds, didn't defend them, and let Saddam go and use chemical weapons and kept giving him chemical weapons, even after he was killing Kurds. So, you know, the United States is just playing both sides over there.
You know who the largest producer of chemical weapons are on the planet, right? That's the U.S. Over 80% of all the chemical weapons worldwide are manufactured in this country. And it's very interesting when we saw what was happening with Assad. Much of, they had no proof that those chemical weapons that they were used by Assad's army. They had no proof. Yeah.
90% of Assad's army are Sunni, by the way.
Right. Yeah. So the situation that we have then, here we get some erroneous information, and then there was like a line that was in the sand, a line that we were going to disregard like we did with, if you remember it, Iraq. There was a line in the sand. And now here, again, a line in the sand, and except for there was such an a strong voice across this country saying no war with Syria, the U.S. was ready to start dropping bombs on Syria. And I might mention that is I might mention we have seen where the Israelis, that they have actually dropped bombs on Syria. But back to what I was saying, no proof of these chemical weapons. And again, we were ready to launch an attack with NATO against Syria. Now, Al, even to today, we still have no proof that there were any chemical weapons being used by the Assad regime. What is your take on that?
Go ahead.
Pardon me?
Go ahead.
What is your take on that?
No, I'm saying, repeat the question again.
The thing is, we were ready to launch an attack, just like we did in Libya. We were ready to launch an attack on Syria because supposedly there was a line in the sand. They had crossed that line. The U.S. was now calling on NATO and other allies to go to war and attack that country. What is your – it seemed like we have a pattern here, and I just want to get your opinion on this pattern because we haven't finished with – we haven't finished with the way this pattern goes because we had Iraq, we had Syria, the pattern also, we had the similar thing that was there in Libya. But what is your take on what took place there in Syria, in Syria in regards to fabrication and also a line that had been crossed?
Well, I mean, the difference between what happened with the intervention in Libya is that NATO was not willing to go along this time, nor was the EU, nor was Britain, which is supposed to be the United States' closest ally, nor was 90% of the American people. You could say the same thing about Iraq, you know, that during 2003, Bush was able to deceive the people to get a significant amount of people behind the war, although there was a lot of people protesting. But this time around, Obama couldn't fool the people. As Lincoln said, you can't fool the people all the time. So there was some differences this time around with Syria. I mean, this time, unlike Libya, Obama did go to the Congress. I don't think the Congress would have passed it either because you're talking about 90% of the people here. You know, we're not very democratic, but when you have 9 out of 10 Americans that are against intervening in Syria, you know, it adds a lot of pressure. And not only that, but, you know, Putin was there. He was trying to make a deal, you know, based on what Kerry was saying about getting rid of the chemical weapons. There is a Russian base in Syria. So there was a risk if there was an aerial attack that Russians could be killed and there could be retaliation there. You think you could say the same thing about Ukraine, right? I mean, what the United States is doing in Ukraine is very risky because, of course, Russia is a major power. It's a nuclear power. It's a member of the Security Council. You know, I was on the radio last night talking about this, about the potentiality for World War III. I mean, it would be terrible. You know, Einstein said... he said, I don't know what weapons would be used in World War III, but I do know that in World War IV, they'd be using sticks and stones. So,
I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, that saying is so correct. Al, we have a lot of ground to cover here because we're going to cover about what's going on in the with the Ukraine, what happened in Crimea, things that's going in the East China Sea. I mean, there's a lot of when we talk about a lawless community and what is taking place on the international scene, we can see that there's a lot of lawlessness that is everywhere. But I just want to very briefly announce that we do have Al Suarez. He's joining our program once again. And Al, he is a political activist and also a writer. And our subject today, the international lawless community. And Al, once again, I want to thank you for joining the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Al, the Ukraine. Now, you know, a lot of people may think that, you know, Russia is not a superpower anymore. But in my opinion, let me ask you, in your opinion, is Russia still a superpower?
Russia is the economic superpower, at least it has the potential to be, especially now that it's uniting with China. And India is also getting in on the alliance, and they're getting rid of the petrol dollar, right? We've talked about this. So this is a big threat, a big economic threat to the American empire. America has the guns, but on the economic front, America's losing. And this is in great part why the United States is backing the fascists in Ukraine, you know, these groups that, you know, the EU condemned, what, like a year ago, being neo-Nazis.
Right.
United States doesn't really care. Just like they didn't really care that there was Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria they supported. And as long as they were going after their enemies and they see Putin as an enemy or a rival, then they'll go ahead and support them. It's like the old saying, the enemy of my enemy is your friend, but that's not always true.
Right. what is taking place there in the Ukraine? We can see, first of all, we were the U.S., and NATO, they were trying to create a defense shield, supposedly a defense shield to protect Europe from any type of potential threat from Iran. Now, the part that was so confusing, you're trying to create a defense shield against Iran, but you want to put a defense shield around the whole perimeter of Russia. And, you know, to me, it baffles me. But at first, we try to potentially create a threat right there on the border of Russia with Georgia, and that completely fell apart, and that was also during Obama's administration.
That was during Bush. Oh, you mean what happened with Obama in Georgia?
Because of the split that was in the country, and it was basically a matter of the state in regards to they had confronted Russia and was sending troops. The U.S. was backing that, sending troops into the eastern part of Georgia. And the U.S. got involved. And then Congress and many members in Congress were saying that Obama was weak and stood down from Russia just because Russia got involved and would not allow troops to be planted right there that were friendly to the U.S., planted there on their border. And that was under Obama. Now, the same situation that we have here, the same situation we have now in the Ukraine, it was what we saw happen there in Crimea, and there was a separation, and also there was an election which voted for that separation, and now there has been constant threats to the eastern part of Ukraine, and also people that are of Russian speaking language. They are under the constant threat from this Kiev regime that has been installed by the U.S. and the EU. Now, my question again, did Russia have, in your opinion, did Russia have a right to protect their interests, or did they have any interest in Ukraine?
Well, you know, number one, Putin is not a pushover. So if they're going to try to make Ukraine, you know, if they're going to try to force it to become a EU member or part of NATO, you know, literally at the borders of Russia and the largest former Soviet Union country besides Russia and Ukraine. And that would be
right.
a major threat to Russia, and any Russian leader with backbone like Putin wouldn't put up with that.
Right.
Historically, large parts of Ukraine have been Russian. The Crimea, almost 100% Russian, and the Khrushchev, the premier of Soviet Union, I believe his parents were Ukrainian.
They were.
He forced the Crimea to be part of Ukraine, a part of Soviet Ukraine. Before
mm-hmm.
that, the Crimeans were always part of Russia, and they always wanted to be part of Russia again. And this time they felt particularly threatened by the Russophobes and the fascists that took over in Kiev. So naturally they had a referendum and voted out of three options to become independent, to be part of Ukraine, or to rejoin Russia. Overwhelmingly voted to rejoin Russia. And I think it was Russia's right, having a fleet there, having a base there since the 1700s, to protect those people and to defend that decision. Now, in Donetsk and Luhansk region of Ukraine, which also borders Russia, they've had a similar referendum and similar results, and they've asked Putin to come to their defense, but Putin has not. Putin has showed restraint. And I don't
right.
say that it's not Russian support in them. They probably have some Russian volunteers there, have some contacts there, and I think that's their right.
Right.
They have far more rights to go and defend their ethnic Russian brothers in Ukraine than the United States does, right, have across the world to go there and send, you know, Blackwater guys or whatever to defend these fascists.
My position is Russia has a right, just like the U.S. has a right, where if we had Russia trying to establish a regime on either side of our border to the north or the south, that would be a major threat to this country and the citizens of this country. Well, the same thing is we, this country, the U.S., I shouldn't say we because I'm not part of that, but you have the same thing in Russia where all of this is right there on their border. I mean, you have we have created an alliance with Poland. We have created an alliance, many of the border states, as I mentioned, with Georgia. You have the Ukraine where we have installed that government. We also have other parts of NATO, which is Great Britain. We have France. All of them are potentially creating a threat for with Russia. So politically thinking, they are doing what's in the best interest of the Russian people. And we have, if you look at the track record of this country over the last two terms, the term and a half that Barack Obama has been in office, he basically has taken over where Bush left off. Bush, when he left office, he had already, we could see the supposedly war on terror and where it had gone. But Barack Obama has taken it even to another level where he has created even a potentially a greater threat to Russia and also many parts of the Far East, including China.
Bush never talked about sanctions against Russia. I mean, this whole sanctions thing is getting out of control.
Right. And most of the world, I'm glad you brought that up in regards to the sanctions, because most of the world, they're laughing at these sanctions. They're sanctions
right,
that we can't even we cannot even enforce. And
well, the sanctions
and China has
silly.
Just completely disregarded these sanctions. Pardon me?
Right. So I'm saying the particular sanctions against Russia, unlike the Iranian sanctions, which are more serious, which are killing poor people in Iran, the sanctions against Putin's government is you know silliness. Because they're only going after certain individuals in his inner circle that are, you know, they're not really hurting Russia. So it's symbolic and silly. And Russia has the power to stop oil to the EU and Ukraine at any time. But
exactly.
I wanted to give an analogy to the Israel-Palestine conflict real quick. Is that all right, or you had something else to say?
Sure, please.
Okay, well, analogy that I've been giving about what's going on in Palestine right now with the bombings in Gaza is, about the three Israeli teenagers that turned up dead, they were kidnapped and all that. As a matter of fact, I was talking with your fan before we got on the air that one of the Palestinian kids that was beaten and arrested by the Israelis is from Tampa. And I do plan to try to get in touch with his family. But anyways, the analogy that I give is
I might mention, Al, he was severely beaten. I mean, it was actually on tape where they were actually kicking him right in the face.
Yes. I'm actually looking at a picture of him right now with his mother. It's quite tragic what happened to him. His cousin, of course, was the one that was burned alive by the settlers. But an analogy that I like to give, a very logical analogy of what's going on in Palestine right now, is, you know, imagine on the Mexican border, right? There's this Mexican group that crosses the border into Texas somewhere and kidnaps three American children, and they end up dead. And then imagine the next day, the American government does an air raid of Mexico City and bombs and kills all these people and goes into Mexico and does all these retaliatory actions. The world would be up in arms. There would be condemnation. They'd say, this is insane. How can you collectively punish Mexico City for what some Mexican individuals did on the border, right? But there's virtual silence now when Israel's bombing the hell out of Gaza and doing all these retaliatory acts in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. So if you use that type of analogy, it's like, what's going on here, you know?
Right. Al, when I see what has taken place there with the Palestinian issue and the way that they are bombing that, you may notice that you don't see anything about this on your regular television. I mean, you have all your local news, you have your national news, but these atrocities that has taken place by the Israeli government is a violation of human civil rights and also international law. And Al, nothing is being said about it. Why is there no debate about this in the UN? Am I missing something here?
Well, they almost brought Sharon to The Hague, and the UN has a responsibility here because they helped make the mandate of Palestine after the British left that got Israeli independence. But you know, the Sharon himself was almost brought to The Hague for atrocities done in Lebanon. Then he went into a coma right before they were going to extradite him. But there was, like, certain countries that he couldn't travel to at that time because they would have sent him to The Hague. So, you know, Israel's not part of the Security Council, but it is protected principally by the United States. But, you know, maybe someday there'll be an Israel leader who'll be off to The Hague because there's plenty of war criminals over there.
Well, the only reason why I see that they're getting as much protection from the U.S. as they're getting, this is just another military base for NATO, the U.S., and what we see taking place again in these lawless areas of the country, of the world. I just want to take another quick pause here just to mention that we have Al Suarez. He's joining our program once again. He's a political activist and also writer. Today on our program, we're discussing the international lawless community. This is our first broadcast under our new heading, Left Turn with Stuart Alexander, and I'm Stuart Alexander joining you today. And thanks again, and thank you, Al, for joining the program.
Right, and I think that leftist, humanist, just decent people in general, when they're looking at the Israel-Palestine conflict in particular, they shouldn't really call it a war, because a war kind of implies that both sides have the equal amount of guns, and it's a genocide, because Palestine has no standing army. They've never had a standing army, not in 1948, not in 1967, not in 1973. The Palestinians have never had a standing army. They've had Arab neighbors that tried to help them out, you know, the Lebanese, the Egyptians, etc. But they've never had a standing army. What they've had is a small militia known as Hamas in Gaza, which is the size of Washington, D.C., which has over a million people, hundreds of thousands of children. And these people are blockaded and bombed almost on a daily basis. And they have, a little security force called the Palestinian Authority. But they have no air force. They basically have kids with stones against tanks. It's a literal, you know, David versus Goliath scenario. This has been going on for decades. So it's not really a war. It's really a genocide. It's an oppressor and an oppressed. And I feel bad for those Israeli children that were killed in Hebron or wherever they were in the West Bank. But we have to describe this scenario as oppressor versus oppressed. And when people say, what do we have to do with it as Americans? Well, our tax dollars are going to this. You know, we're
right,
literally
exactly.
bankrupting ourselves, supporting Israel. The empire's bankrupt, so Israel doesn't even need the support anymore. It's a top military and economic power. The United States continues to support Israel, and they have a very strong lobby in Washington and very much influence over the media and how things are portrayed. And, you know, something needs to be done about it.
I'm just going to read this very briefly, what you were talking about, the cost it is to the American people. It says, American public doesn't seem to mind a Pew, and I'm just sort of taking this out of context, a Pew research poll conducted in December 2013 found that for the first time in the 50 years, Pew has asked this question. A majority of U.S. respondents say that the U.S. should mind its own business internationally
yep.
and let other countries get along the best they can on their own. Just 38% disagree. That's a double-digit shift from the historical norm. A full 80% agree that the United States should not think so much in international terms, but concentrate more on their own international problems. So you can see where the thinking is, Al, in this country. People don't want us thinking about what's going on internationally and getting involved in international affairs to the degree that we have been getting involved, but they want our leaders, our politicians, to concentrate on taking care of the problems that we have here. The more we create problems abroad, the less we can take care of the problems here at home. And I just want to inject this real quick. When we think about all that the hundreds of billions that we're spending abroad and trillions trying to rebuild other countries that we have just completely demolished, and then you think about those people there in Detroit, their water is being turned off. Water. Al, this is a basic human right. I think about this
humanity.
Every day. Pardon me?
It's a crime against humanity.
That's a crime against humanity.
It's a class war. They got to take it to the UN. I mean, you're talking about 100,000. Some of these people even paid their bills. It's a form of collective punishment. It's almost like what they're doing in Gaza. They're completely cutting off the water, and Detroit was suffering as it was. I mean, Detroit looks like a war zone. Money that be going to rebuild Detroit is going to build more towers in Tel Aviv.
But I just wanted to get that in there real quick. And the money should be spent here taking care of our problems, because we have more than enough problems to take care of. Moving on, Al, you mentioned, you know, Palestine is an area that stays on my heart all the time, because this is worse than what we saw happening during the time of the apartheid movement there in South Africa. I mean, it was a lot of deaths. It was segregation, discrimination against blacks. But here we have a government that is actually going and dropping bombs on communities. We have military jets that are flying above cities, populated areas, and killing people at random, because here's a government that is completely out of control. And if anyone think that, I'm a sympathizer for the Israeli government, I am not, because, you know, they have been involved in so many criminal acts against humanity. I cannot side with that country when it comes to these actions.
And if you look at what Mandela said or Tutu said about the Israeli occupation, they said, well, you just said that it's worse than apartheid, and they would know, right? I mean, they were political prisoners. And
right,
it's not
exactly.
only against it's not only against non-Jews, okay? There's also discrimination and crimes against humanity against Jews in Israel, against their fellow Jews, whether they're political activists fighting on the side of the Palestinians, or whether they're Ethiopian Jews or even Sephardic Jews, darker-skinned Jews, instead of the Ashkenazim, which are descendants of a lot of them of the Khazars that have no roots there in the region. But, for example, the Ethiopian women that migrated to Israel, a lot of them were sent to, you know, ghetto poor communities in Tel Aviv or wherever they were sent, and then they brought them into the doctor, and they had forced insemination on a lot of them, so they couldn't have children. These are Jews here. But because
mm-hmm.
they're from Africa, and a lot of them, the Israelis refuse to take blood from them when they want to donate blood, because they say, oh, it probably has AIDS, it's from Africa. So there's a lot of racist things against their fellow Jews as well. So you can imagine how they treat non-Jews.
Right. Well, I know myself, when I went to Israel, I went there in 1981, and I went there just as for a visit. And as soon as I stepped off the plane, I got a quick interrogation, probably that lasts less than an hour. They were able to verify all my travel arrangements and everything. I guess the surprise was when I stepped off the plane, they said, "Hey, he's black." And then that's when my trouble started. And within an hour, they had a paddy wagon there for me. They took me off to a detention center, and I spent a night in jail. So I went halfway around the world just so I could spend a night in jail.
Wow.
So now so much for
like,
the trip.
And
I have no interest of going to Israel since then.
Yeah, it's like, what are you doing here? You're not Jewish. Are you from Ethiopia? It's like, no, I'm an American citizen. I could imagine.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's really tragic right now is I just heard from the courtroom, okay, you know, with this guy that went into house arrest, Tariq Kader, who's from Tampa, 15 years old, brave kid. He's
right.
In house arrest right now before he returns. And in the courtroom, when his mother was finally able to see his beaten face, she went to hug him.
You say he's under house arrest?
Yeah, he's still under house arrest until the 16th. He
was for what reason?
You know, for supposedly throwing stones, I don't know, but there's no evidence to back that. But in the courtroom, though, his mother went to try to hug him, okay, and the Israeli judge was going to try to stop her, and as soon as he saw the U.S. consulate come into the courtroom, then he backed off and said, "Go ahead, you can touch your son now." But, you know, they know that he's an American citizen. Can you imagine
right.
if he was just Palestinian? Will we even know about him? I mean, how
just because he's an American citizen doesn't mean anything.
Right. So if it wasn't for the U.S. consulate's intervention there, you know, the U.S. consulate didn't care very much about American citizens on their flotilla. I was talking with Ruth Ann about this earlier. I mean, when they tried to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza, there was United States citizens on that flotilla. And they were held for days by Israelis. There was even an American citizen who was killed on the flotilla. But this time around, you know, you've had Netanyahu come out and you know, Mohammed Kader, you know, his cousin that was burned alive, you know, condemned that as a retaliatory act, even though he incited that same violence, right? So now because, you know, this guy happens to be American, you know, they're kind of condemning what's being done to him. But let him return home. He has to stay in house arrest for the rest of his... He can't even go back to the neighborhood in East Jerusalem where he's from, where he was captured and beaten so brutally by these... And these weren't Israeli settlers doing it. These are Israeli soldiers. Israeli soldiers are defending the settlers, you know. They're trying to differentiate. They're one and the same.
Now, I just want to focus on some other areas when I look at this international community and some of the things that are taking place within recent years. Obviously, everyone knows about Snowden these days and much of what he released from the NSA. And what I find very interesting is how this government has been found... They have identified where the U.S. government has spied on other leaders of the world, including in Brazil. The Russians have always been on alert, even in recent years, of them spying there in that country. And even with some of the partners of the U.S., when we saw that Chancellor Merkel, that she was being spied on. But now it's being taken for granted that it's okay because it's against international terrorism. I don't even know if they even associate it with international terrorism as much as just saying that it's okay. But, Al, I just want you to explain a little bit about what has taken place with the NSA, because what has taken place with much of these the spying that's done over the Internet and that's done with cameras that are placed everywhere in our workplace, in our homes, on the streets. I mean, and what we have seen that has been revealed to us, which we supposedly Obama was going to bring us a transparent government, and the person where we got the transparent government from was Edward Snowden. You know, there's a little bit of irony here. But what is your opinion about, you know, this spying that has taken place not only on governments but it has taken place worldwide, and we're the leaders of this, and it's being accepted in the international community. Could you help me here?
Well, okay, first I want to mention that I'm going to buy soon Greenwald's new book, which exposes a lot of this. As you know, Greenwald was the journalist who worked with The Guardian and getting the revelations, the leaks out that Edward Snowden showed. And, you know, he recently had a book tour back here in the United States for his new book, and I tend to get that so I can look more into it. But Merkel, who you mentioned earlier, you know, if she had half the backbone of Putin, she'd stand up and say, look, you guys have spied on me. This is enough. I want
right.
the U.S. base out of my country. They can
right.
throw U.S. bases out of Latin American countries. They, you know, I want the U.S. bases out of my country, and I don't want to go along with supporting neo-Nazis in Ukraine because we have a terrible history here in this country. I'm not going to put up with that. Instead, Merkel has the whole investigation and the spying on her and her government, you know, thrown out the window. So she's really showing herself, I don't know any other way to say it, but a slave of the United States. It's not even a question
right.
of, is she your partner? Is she accomplice? No, she's really turned into a slave of the United States at this point.
Right, exactly. I agree.
And, yeah, and, you know, it really, what Snowden did vindicated what we've been saying for a long time, Stuart, you know. Us leftists have been talking forever about government spying, and we're called, you know, paranoid, you know, nut jobs, conspiracy theorists, blah, blah, blah. When Snowden showed with the facts that what we have been saying for years was true. So what Snowden did was a vindication. I think he deserves all our support, and I hope that someday he can come back to the United States. See, the difference between me and Greenwald, I have all the respect in the world for him, and I loved what he was saying and the debates he was taking part in when he returned to the United States. But the difference between me and Greenwald is, when Greenwald was asked if he thought Snowden would ever return to the United States, he said
right.
that he didn't see it happening, and I completely understand the reasons behind that. He would be silenced, you know, incommunicado or whatnot. But I would have said, I don't see that happening until there's revolution. So we need to have a
right.
little more optimism behind this message, that there is a chance that Snowden come back to a hero's welcome. But the only way that's going to happen is with revolution, not with reform. Because, as you know, I was in the left forum, and I was, you know, the debate was on reform revolution, and I was really surprised there was not more people coming out against reform. Because that's, you know, that's pretty much a bomb right there, reformism, you know, or at least fake reform. But you know what? We need to go beyond reform. We need a transformative revolutionary movement in this country.
Oh, say that one more time. I need to hear that.
We need a transformative revolutionary movement in this country. We need to go beyond reform.
Right. No, well, you know me. I don't believe in reforms. We're so far. Once we came to the realization what was taking place in this country, you know, reforms don't happen. They won't happen. You know, that's what the Greens are all about. If you're trying to reform the U.S. government, then register with the Greens. But you're right, Al. We're talking about revolution. We need revolutionary change in this country. And reform is not going to do that. If you're looking for reforms, keep putting the Democrats in office because they talk about reforms. Of course, you won't get them, but basically that's all you're going to get is just a lot of rhetoric.
There's a lot of revolutionaries and a lot of groups and third parties or former occupiers. They're there. They're just waiting for the opportunity to unite. And we need to provide the conditions for us to unite. We don't have to wait for the conditions. We have to make the conditions.
Al, we have approximately another 10 minutes, and I have a few more areas, and I want you to talk about some of the things that are in your most recent books that you put out. Again, and every time I think about what is going on in the international community and the lawlessness that has taken place in world politics, right away the U.S. always comes to the forefront. I mean, when we talk about crossing borders, when we talk about what is taking place there in Pakistan and the drones, I mean, here, we don't even hear talk about these drones on television, Al, but here, I think we have killed somewhere close to 2,500 people. I'm pretty accurate with those numbers with these drones, am I correct?
Hundreds of children.
Right,
And four U.S. citizens killed via drone as well.
Right. The numbers was for every target, every person was a target of a drone, every person. Six innocent people were killed. But we here in this country are saying that, you know, for the sake of the targets that they had, that had been targeted by these drones, it was worth killing those additional people. To me, Al, something is wrong with that logic there. To say
and
that you can go
can
and kill innocent
people. Yeah, they're used to survey on people and to help them go and capture people. I mean, if they're able to capture this guy in Libya recently, you know, why do they have to go and bomb all these people with them? They just go and capture them and bring them to court. You know, the thing is, they don't have evidence on a lot of these people. They just go and they bomb, and it helps recruit the terrorists more than anything.
Right. So, I mean, in regards to the drones, I mean, to me, what has taken place here, drones should be like, like they were outlawing chemical weapons after World War One. Seem like drones should be outlawed. I mean, it seemed like that's a in my opinion now, it appears to be a criminal act. And we don't have any political body, world political body, that is standing up to make a decision that that there's a wrong that is being done in the international community when it comes to these drones. And it's being embraced by this government. Pardon me?
Yes. The U.S. had a monopoly on drones for a while, but I'm going to tell you that right now the name of the countries that I know of that have access to drones. Iran, Ecuador, Brazil, and there was one other one I escaped in my mind right now. But, so the United States think that they're going to have monopoly over drones. I mean, just like they thought they'd have monopoly over nuclear weapons. Well, that's true. There's other countries that are going to start getting drones, and, you know, things can get out of hand with these drones.
So, I mean, as I mentioned, in my opinion, Al.
Israel has drones. Yeah.
Right. And you might mention nukes also.
Well, of course. Israel's had nukes since, the late 60s. They were trying to get nukes in the early 60s, and Kennedy put a stop to it. But by the late 60s, I think they were already increasing
In the late 60s is when they got them. And I might mention they got those from the U.S. I'm just going to cover a couple of other areas because, you know, China was supposedly a trading partner, and supposedly they're still a trading partner with the U.S. And now China has even come under certain threats from the U.S. because of their foreign policy in the China Seas. Also, they have come under certain threats because of their relationship with Russia. But when you look at internationally, is China, even though they have been trading with the U.S. for close to a decade now, as far as where the relationships have improved, are they potentially under the same threat that we see there in Russia?
You're saying that the Chinese are facing a similar threat to the Russians? Is that what you're asking?
No. What I'm saying is when you see, you know, Russia has not played into the hands of supporting the U.S. and NATO just going in various countries, and what we saw even with Syria. Russia, when they had the various sanctions against Russia in regards to Crimea, the sanctions that the U.S. was trying to push there in the U.S., but China would not support those sanctions. And they needed the vote there in the Security Council to be able to get those types of sanctions supported in the international community. Does this put China also at odds with the U.S., not looking at the economic relationship, but politically and militarily, does it put them in a precarious situation with the U.S. government and also their allies?
Well, let me tell you this. Putin is a capitalist, but there is some socialism in Russia. There are some social programs, kind of like the EU, although the EU is in crisis right now. And China still has to kind of appear communist. So politically, there are some similarities between Russia and China. They certainly are united economically. And China is a threat to the United States, particularly because the United States has a huge economic debt to China. you know, shipping job overseas, whatnot. So China's emerging as a power now, and it's uniting with Russia in great part because of the advances that the United States is doing with NATO. It's threatening both Russia and China and kind of pushing China into the arms of Russia.
And I might mention that China is also building a military. I don't support all these countries, the buildup of military powers, but, I mean, you know, I'm not blind, and I, you know, if I see something taking place, I mean, it's a fact, but we can see that militarily, I mean, Japan is building up militarily. We see that China now is the second largest, has the second largest defense budget, which they spent $188 billion in the last year. We see that we see the U.S. spent well over $675 billion. So we're the number one power in regards to military spending, and we become the number one nuisance in the world community. Al, just one other thing that I want to just focus on, and then I want you to just speak a little bit about your book. We have around 5 minutes here. My opinion, and I've been very open about this, Al, is that I believe that the UN, the United Nations, I believe it has now become a very useless organization. I think if it's to continue, it needs to be continued off the shores of the U.S. What is your opinion in regards to that?
Well, I think much like every year, I think it's every year, the EU has a different president, right? The president of the entire EU, they switched to different European nations, that there should be a different host country for the UN. They shouldn't have a permanent base in the United States or headquarters. And also, number one, you need to abolish the Security Council. And also, you need to abolish the conditions of economic colonialism. The United States can coerce, you know, several African nations and other nations into their will by economic means. So if you abolish those conditions, those countries can vote freely when it comes to world decisions.
Right. And so you seem to side with my opinion the same way, that we should abolish the Security Council, and we need to have other host nations in regards to where the UN is doing business. Al, I would like for you to take a couple of minutes just to give some information about the books that you have actually put out. If you can take maybe around 2 or 3 minutes. You have several books out. What are the names of those books?
Well, actually, two, and I'm working on my third right now, which is a fiction. And as you know, probably the fictions are very hard to write. The first one is about the Occupy movement. It's called The Struggle of an Occupier. You can find it on Amazon if you look Al R. Suarez. Suarez, S-U-A-R-E-Z, under the same author's name. The last book that I wrote earlier this year is called The Unfinished Revolution. And a lot of things we talked about, the revolutionary scenarios, trying to build a more revolutionary movement in the United States, are discussed in The Unfinished Revolution book.
And Al, you said The Unfinished Revolution. How do we finish this revolution? How do we move forward with this revolution?
Right. I think a revolution has to be constant as well, because we can't lay down our vigilance once we've been victorious, right? Because then a Stalin or a Napoleon can come around and betray the revolution. We don't want somebody to come around and be a false prophet. We have to see the characteristics of a false prophet. I dedicate a whole chapter to that. But, you know, people can also find me on Facebook, Al Suarez, S-U-A-R-E-Z. I'm on Stewart's page. I'm on the fans page. And I often put up notes and articles about these issues for social justice.
And, Al, once again, I want to thank you for joining our program today. We have had Al Suarez joining our program today. It's our first program and broadcast where we have done under our new title, Left Turn with Stewart Alexander. And now I'll be looking forward to having you to join us in 2 weeks, once again on Left Turn with Stewart Alexander. Thanks again. Thanks again, Al. Thanks again, Ruth Ann. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Thank you, guys. Good night. You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Good evening and welcome to the dialogue. I'm Ra, and here is Ken Withrow and Karen Patrick.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm not as bad off as Karen is. It's 95 degrees in Texas, she tells me.
That's awful. That is awful. It felt like 95 yesterday, but it definitely was not. We were took the family to go. There was a festival raising money for a camp cost for kids at this farm near us, and it was Buckwheat Zydeco and the Wood Brothers, and then a couple local bands, Special Consensus is a bluegrass band, and it was awesome. And then my friend's band, Chester Brown, a guy I used to do a lot of shows with and stuff, those guys all play. But what was cool was the Wood Brothers and Buckwheat Zydeco. It was just like a great way to top out the day. And what was awesome was it was cloudy off and on with about 80-something degrees, and sitting up on a field in the woods, you know, right on the edge of the woods with your whole family, and you go home by 8 o'clock.
Oh, wow.
So you get a full day. Yeah, like we got a full day, and I mean, I had my baby, all the kids running around. They did great. The show went good. They made money, and, you know, it was a nice crowd, and it was just an awesome afternoon. So, sorry, Karen. But I'm having a better time than you right now.
Oh, hey, no, I'm not that far from Louisiana. So now you're talking about Zydeco and
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not that far from Shreveport, actually. So.
Wow.
Good music. That's good music.
He definitely got the crowd moving. And by the time the Wood Brothers came up, they were, like, ready to jump. And the kids were, like, they brought kids up on the stage. I mean, it was a really
so
fun show.
I love all the ages thing. That's really great.
Expose
the kids to music.
I've been trying to do more of that and a lot less of the other festivals. And it's kind of why I pulled out of the music industry for a while. Is just didn't want to. There was nothing like that. And, you know, I got a family. I want to spend time with them. I want them to experience what I used to experience, and that kind of disappeared with modern music for a while, and now it's coming back, I think, because a lot of the people that were, like, really pushing the envelope now have families, and so now they're coming back and, like, trying to do stuff about it, and plus, you know, like, we've been talking about, like, corporate stuff. The music industry is another one of those weird corporate machines that rape the artists, and now the artists are pissed off, and instead of fighting it, they're just like, you know what? Like, look at Radiohead, what they did with that one album where it was pay what you want, you know? Like, you don't have to pay anything. Download it. And they made more money off that album than they did any of the other studio albums.
Well,
yeah,
sure.
It's just...
Studios to pay off. A lot of independent musicians and book authors are going that
way. Authoring, too. Yeah, that was... Yeah. One of the reasons why I felt secure with going back to writing was that I'm seeing authors actually making a living without publishers. And the publishers are raping them, and these guys are starving. And it's like living on grant money. You know, you're living on all of your advances, but you're not really – you only get somewhere if you have a big seller.
Right, and even if they aren't quite keen on that, maybe if they have a part-time job or somebody else in their family does, at least – they haven't sold themselves, and they have that independence, and, you know, that means so much to so many of us, so
you're barking up my tree here, because I've got two books out.
I
love it.
I totally
One
know.
One book was on gumroad.com, so if there's authors that are interested, and they have a pay-what-you-want option right there at the digital publishing platform, and they have got that pay-what-you-want option, and we actually got a couple books where people paid double the price that was requested just to support our work, the books that Brown and I did, And then I have another book that's just on archive.org, which has got a tremendous amount of materials on it that people are just saying, hey, the market for this is too small. I'm just going to throw it out there and see what happens, you know, mm-hmm. and let people enjoy it. I think that the open source movement's going to get very interesting as people find a way to provision their lifestyle some other way that they're mm-hmm. happy with. And then they just share, because it gets around the curation, right? Like mm-hmm. you're saying, like the publishers curate what they think is going to be important, and it can completely wipe out. If you get a weird, obscure topic that's not mainstream or whatever, your project will never see the light of day. Self-publishing was another way to kind of get trapped, because you'd be like back in the day, you'd have to buy, you know, a whole entire box of books, and then you'd have to, you know.
Yeah, you would.
Give them away for Christmas for now. Like 10 years. You know?
Because we've got the e-book mm-hmm. now, and people can also do the print on demand. And
yeah.
They may not make as much per whatever, but they still, again, have all that freedom. So that makes a big difference. I wanted to ask Karen to explain provisions a little more. People have asked because, you know,
yeah.
Word out.
That's
yeah,
become a
okay.
staple term in our conversation.
Well, it's a nuanced, it's kind of a nuanced
you know,
term.
But, the other day, you had mentioned that provisions, this does not necessarily just mean like water and food. There's a lot of other things
yeah.
involved. So if you would, talk a little on that, and Ken and I'll jump in.
Okay, I'll totally get that. Due to various circumstances, I'll just say it straight up. I am a caregiver that injured myself, and my patient, which happened to be my daughter, went into professional care. You know, she went to a care facility, and that happened right at the downturn of the economy. So I was a caregiver with a hurt back with nothing else on my resume. So I've had the odd job at hardcore. And what I kind of developed is the concept of provisioning is not just your, like you said, food and water, but it's like, how am I going to get clothing? How am I going to get, at one point I traded, I was the front desk, it's work-related, it's bartering. I just put the whole shebang under provisioning. How am I going to provision this need without a monetary exchange and really rethink how do I do this? And I was, forced to do it by circumstances or whatever. And then I started getting in with other people who do the same thing, and it's a really interesting, different way of thinking about it, because before, a householder, your household, you thought in terms of a budget and how am I going to buy the food, and it was all money, monetarily measured, okay? When you kind of say, if you're really restricted in monetary capacity, right, a lot of us are, you take money's not the first thing you think of. You think of, here's the need, how can I provision it, and money's the last option that you take, because the cash flow is king kind of thing, or queen, or however you want to look at it. So it's the concept of how can I develop relationships with people that I can trade with, how can I... I at one point looped in my mother in my household to cook for, so we went over and cooked at her house and shared the meal, because it's hard to cook for one person. And she had a mm-hmm. period of time where her health wasn't good. So it was easier for me to go a couple times a week and cook at her house, and we all shared the cost of the meal or whatever. And then we had, leftovers in her freezer that she could eat. So it's just rethinking step by step by step, day by day, how am I going to do this with the least amount of monetary involvement, or none if you can? And then it becomes a thing where you you're going to be going to the food bank, you're going to be to the clothing bank. There's no shame in that, I don't believe, if you're provisioning your house well. You do what you have to do. And forget about status, forget about your pride, forget about what money is. Oh, I can go out to eat all the time. Hey, don't go out to eat all the time. That's not always the best way to provision your food, because the food value isn't that great. What I found out about mm-hmm. the restaurant industry is that they have these systems where they bring basically the same kind of low-quality food, and it's packaged in a certain way, and they haven't cooked that food back there. All they've done is reheat it. So it's like you got to rethink how the systems are for how you eat every meal and everything that you wear. You know, don't buy clothing or have clothing come into your provision that's flimsy. That's important. That's why everybody loves jeans, right? Because you can wear them till they're threadbare, you know. Wonderful item of clothing there.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and one thing I was going to mention, because I just think it's so important, this is a weird thing, get cast iron cookware. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Because if there is a power outage or something like that, you can build a fire and you can still cook, right?
Oh, cast iron is the most wonderful
It's so important to have that, and think in terms of when you have a systems breakdown. When I lived in Washington State, we had severe windstorms and ice storms at least a couple times a year to knock the power out. I actually went 8 days without power one time with 3 young children. And so think about when your system breakdown happens, what's your provisioning for that? And they call that prepping, and that's a big deal and all. But I think prepping kind of people that are preparing 3 days, 3 ways, whatever, dried eggs and whatever, is shifting to permaculture concepts, because this should be your baseline. You should always know. I read an article, I think I shared it with you guys, about a gentleman who's lived without cash for 10 years in Great Britain.
Yeah,
and the first thing he says is learn to forage. Learn what you can eat if there's nothing in the house. I've actually am now... had a lot of interaction with people who are doing that. They're going in Washington State, they're going out and they're getting mushrooms, they're learning mycology. You know, there's mycology classes you can take to learn what edible mushrooms you can have, what few things you can start putting in your yard, like grow something edible instead of something that's pretty, you know. Right. One gal that I went to a classes with, was her business model, was to do edible landscaping. And then, but also learn, in rank emergency, you got nothing, you've had a total breakdown either personally or in your community, know where your water is, besides what comes out of the tap. I learned that from working with the Artesian Well Project. Know where... what you can eat right out of it. You can eat dandelions, and they are actually nutritionally very sound, even though they're an eyesore in a lawn, right? It's the concept that you start really thinking about how to live at a different level if need be. And with the news I've been looking at this week with the potential economic issues in the United States, that's a really good idea. More than ever.
But, and you can add it. Let's assume that the States doesn't collapse. It still takes – and I think we're all in agreement that there is a collapse already occurring. It's coming down. But let's assume that that weren't there. If you were trying to spawn a better society that thinks holistically, that's the core thinking. Provision versus material gain. You're not looking for, like you said, like the next fashion, or you're not going to, a franchise restaurant. You may go to the, if you're like, I got a little extra money, you support your community, you're going to throw your money into a small restaurant where the owner's cooking the food in the back from scratch. It's how they feed their family. You hit it on the head.
I was in Walmart having a big decision over what kind of mop to get. Because if you get one of those little plasticky things where you have to replace the mop head, you have to go back and buy a mop head, once a month or whatever. That's not a good long-term solution. You should just buy an old-fashioned one that you can wash the mop head of,
They're better anyway. One of the things I think about with provision is it's abilities. It's things that you can do. We, especially in the pagan world, we've always heard about toolbox. This and that. So I got this thing, if you had just a few different kinds of abilities that you either are born with, your parents showed you, whatever, it's the equivalent, you've got a tool belt, Then come like a tool bag. You have a few more things in there. Then we go to the toolbox. Then we've got the tool chest. Those big double-decker things with wheels, those great huge red things with a tool.
I like this.
So I think that for all of us to try to get that far would be a good thing. You were talking about the clothes and things, and one of the tools people can learn is how to sew. And maybe they're never going to.
Oh, my God, that's a great one.
But, you can put a button on. You can hem something.
Mm-hmm.
There's different things, but all of these abilities, and we all have so many that we don't even think about. I think that's the funny thing. So we know how to do so many things, but we just take it for granted. We learned it along the way. Sometime, just sit down and start making a list of the things that you really know how to do. You're going to
that's
be very
idea.
Shocked. Very shocked.
That's actually really, really funny that nobody probably really does that, sits down and makes a list of what can you produce as a provision, go to the provision concept for your house, and what can't you?
But what can you do? It doesn't even have to be produced, but what can you do? And so maybe you, because here again, it's something that you can offer to people. Maybe you have this great eye, and maybe you can just like beautify places more than someone else. Maybe you are good at, you can envision, you've got this artist eye, you can see how the garden yard could be. You can help. You know, you just have these different things. Maybe you've got the green thumb. But then there's all these things you can teach yourself, whether it's sewing or cooking at least something.
There's a lot of standard day-to-day stuff. Like sewing, you keep bringing it up, and it's dead on. Like, there was a time when everyone knew how to sew. There was a time when everyone had needle and thread in their house, and it was like mustard in the fridge, you know? Like, that was just something you did. You brush your teeth, you would sew, you know, throw a patch on something, and it's just things have gotten so, well, society has gotten so dependent on accessibility and not resourceability, you know? Like, we used to be able to find our shit. You know, and work it, and make it, and get
it,
and now it's like,
The concept Brett and I have been talking about a lot is consumerist. So it's if the stock has the hole, you throw it away. It's the disposable thing, which is a wonderful thing for corporate profit. It may not be the most wonderful thing for your personal household to constantly be consuming things. I hope a value that changes through this economic downturn and problems that people have as we start thinking of valuing abundance over scarcity and valuing permanence over temporary. The things that you have that are going to stick around for a while and be useful, like a cast iron. In fact, that's a good place to get cast iron is go to an antique shop, because cast iron, it just goes generation after generation after generation. You know, you can buy those little, you know, thin aluminum pans they have at the store, or you know, electrical devices that plug in and the plug wears out or breaks. Or you can go get something that, it's kind of old-fashioned and heavy and weird, but it's like been around forever and it's permanent. It's a permanent item to replace something that's become temporary.
Cast iron is classy. The aluminum, in the first place, we know cooking in aluminum is deadly for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common.
That's
cooking
great.
With those no-stick thingies. Again, it's very toxic, you know, so just for health purposes only, cast iron is the way to go. Stainless steel lasts a long time, and it's not hard on you either. But, you know, people
stainless steel, though, does take a beating, like with your, you know, like it'll work, and it's decent for certain things, but, like, it's not repairable once damaged. And, like, iron can't get damaged in the way stainless steel can. Like, we ended up getting cast iron skillets. We got a set a few years ago. And I'm just like, oh, God, I don't want to deal with that heavy, clunky thing. You know what? We started, like, and we basically, it sits on the stove. And, you know, you don't wash it like you wash a normal. Wash it, you heat it. And you keep your oil in there, and you just scrape the old food. You burn your food off, basically.
Yeah.
And then you scrape, and every now and then you might want to scrub it and re-oil it, but it's rare. And you maintain it, and the thing's heavy and clunky, so you get used to it. Now, like, I feel weird cooking in any other kind of pan, because this is the pans we have now, and we love them. And, like, it's funny when you cast iron being the thing that got brought up, but it's very symbolic of what we need to be doing with everything. Like, when you buy a shoe, you know, like, I buy flip-flops that, you know, and I look for a durable flip-flop because that's my standard shoe. If I'm going to spend $20, I could make those things last a year. Now, there's a running joke that I wear sandals basically from March to November, and it's kind of true. It's from growing up surfing in the Pacific Ocean. Everything's cold. My feet, like, barely get affected anymore by the cold. So, like, you know, Indiana Winters really are when I, and you know, I will start donning more of the work boot. And even my boots, like, I went and I got very good boots for work and wearing around. And in the harshest environments, in the harshest work environments, they still will last forever. And so, like, yeah. I started really thinking about that. Like, you know, I look for utilitarian ways to dress, things that, when I buy a backpack, that shoulder strap, I can hold 15 books in the damn thing, and it's not going to rip. And, you know, right now it may cost you $100, but I used to get a backpack every year, especially when I was in school, you know, 10 years of college. I would not only haul my school books, but I also haul my projects, art projects, reading, you know, everything was in that backpack because you lived at school all day, every day, you know, if you weren't at work. And most of the time you never went home because you went straight to work. So, like, I started thinking about that, like, what, if you're going to do something or go get something, you get it where it's, you know, like a cast iron skillet. Like, the thing cannot be destroyed.
Yeah.
And then you make it last. You spent the money. You're also going to think to make it last.
Right. Well, that's true, too. And that's what they used to always encourage people, to buy quality. And and quality does not always mean the most expensive either, because a lot of...
No, it doesn't.
Think that.
Oh,
it doesn't.
But I would do that for shoes. I would do that for backpacks. But other items of clothing, the last thing I do is try to spend money on it, because there's... You know, there's people you can trade with. There's the clothing bank. There's the in Goodwill. You step up to the little... shops like that, and the last place I'm going to go to is like the mall or something like that for sort of the non-essentials.
You can get.
I found a brand new pair of sandals, like good hiking sandals, like, you know, with almost like a tennis shoe. They were brand new for $1 at this thrift shop we discovered, and it's like, you know, you're right. Like, it's back to it's the same concept as food foraging, you know. But then if we look at like. You know, when we're going into it, trying to get a society to transition over, a lot of these things are only transitionary tools, because there's going to come a point where the thrift shops will be empty because everyone's broke and making their shit last. So then you're like, oh, but what it's going to do is force society to stop thinking in the corporatistic mind frame of design, you know, to, you know, what is it, designed obsolescence,
to fail.
I guess.
Yeah,
it's going, it has to break. If it doesn't break, you're not buying next year's model.
Right.
So it's going to change the way things happen. Corporations will be forced to change because nobody will be able to purchase what they're putting out.
Wait,
and so then they have to do it.
We talked once about the car situation where they literally, because they keep making cars every year, they've taken thousands and thousands of hundreds of thousands of cars of this coming last year, and they warehoused them. They've just mothballed them because they don't want to flood the market.
They're out in the, many of them, because I've seen pictures of several of these. They're just out like in the boonies somewhere. They bought up acres, and that's where they are.
Which is creepy.
I mean,
well, they
do
that because they're not going to make any money off the, you know, the capitalism's idea is if the supply exceeds the demand, then the price goes down. They've got so many that they'd be having to give them away. So they would rather mothball them and make money off the people who do buy a car and get a bank loan. The key here is the banks involved, right? If it was just us and the car companies, then they would have to eat it, you know, and we'd get a car for $100. But because the banks are the third party in the deal, it's the bank saying, hey, we don't want to take a bath on this. You're going to mothball these cars, and you're going to mothball houses, too. So they're mothballing cars, mothballing houses, and reducing the supply so they can keep the price at some kind of level where they make money. And that's why we have homeless people and people with homes, right?
Yeah. It's very true.
Depending on the stats that you read, for every homeless person, there's between 13 and 18 empty houses in the U.S.
That's maddening.
So that is nothing but disgraceful. Just disgraceful.
So what's going on is not capitalism. It's some other mechanism, and it has something to do with the banks, hint, hint, is that I was told I went to a conservative university where we were taught macroeconomics, where they told us about when supply exceeds demand, the price goes down. And I'm in this weird cartoon Dr. Seuss world, right, where we have lots of people who need a home. We have empty houses all around me. How come we can't make a match? We have cars, people needing cars, and cars being mothballed, and they're still costing the same as they did 10 years ago or whatever. Your car payment's always about $200 to $300, right? Or maybe mine was. Maybe I'm a cheapo. But anyway, you know, it's this whole, like, something, some other mechanism is going on that's just not people-oriented. It needs at all. It has nothing to do with needs.
It's because capitalism and the corporations, the multinational rulers of the world, are not interested in people as people. They want the drones. They want the robots. And so they will do whatever it takes to keep people dummied down and in the state of, I want to say, like, alienation, divided, because they don't want people to band together with a common cause.
I got a weird side note on you just saying that. Karen, you'll probably really, this could get really to home because there's a family member that this ties directly to who's got me to change my opinion on this scenario, and that is the police force in the nation. I got caught in a very long conversation because I'd posted on Facebook an article about this guy that beat a mentally handicapped woman, a cop, and, you know, and just the reactions of, I put it out there because I wanted to start engaging in a discussion of an actual solution, not a bitch and finger-pointing fest of them, they, them, you know, the Nazis, this and that. Because it's like, we just got through this long discourse, us, about separatory devices, you know, and I'm seeing it firsthand because I had these two, you know, good friends, totally, like, you know, pardon my friends, but they're like, fuck the pigs, fuck, you know, they need this and that, and it was yelling and anger, and I'm like, I feel the same anger, but I know enough police officers, sheriffs, and state and whatnot, in many states, you know, as Karen, you know one of them with me, and they're not like that, and it's like, so I'm seeing, I see it out there, and then I see the violence. I'm like, I'm not saying the violence ain't there, and I'm not saying it doesn't need to be reprimanded and handled. What I'm saying is you got basically an entire country of people being separated in many, many ways. And the one thing is there was a time when that wasn't the case. What was going on during that time that case did not occur? And, well, one, we appointed sheriffs, and, you know, they were part of the town. They lived in the town. They worked in the town. They were part of the town. But the people that they sheriffed, they knew them. Now, and I come from a pretty edgy community. You know, I'm full-on music industry hippie. You know, grew up doing all my crazy stuff. I'm an activist, you know. So I've been arrested more times than I got fingers. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where I look at it and I'm like, I had more cops while processing me go, you're not the guy we should be arresting. Okay, nice guys like you should not be in here. Like, they don't even like the job they have to do. And I'm like, so where did the corruption ladder, where's the wrong where it changes scene? If the guys on the bottom are just the Nazi pushing the red button, don't know what it means, don't know what it does, but if I don't push this red button, my family suffers or whatever, you know, like,
it's pretty widespread.
There's a
break point. It's widespread. It is. What you said, this is true. People, the police used to live in the area that they police. They are, in many cases, they're still supposed to, but many, many, many thousands and thousands upon thousands get around that. They have a friend that lives in the town, so they'll use that address. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing.
Oh, dude, it happens with firemen, too, and everything. Yeah. Any, you know, government, but it's not really all that. It's we've raised a society of disconnected people. Like, when I worked at the mill, I was offered, you know, run water treatment. You know, we need a chemist who can learn automation engineering and get in and do this. Okay, cool. I took the job, and I ended up being a default environmentalist, not a protector of the environment, but a please don't let this happen because we're going to fuck up and spill shit. You're the guy that makes sure it gets covered. There's a butterfly sanctuary right next to my plant. And we had acid spills all the time. We had, I mean, like, literally, it was the most stressful thing because they would dump water, and they had all these crazy spills, and it was my job to clear it up. If I didn't do it, I would lose my job. I was under the union.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I have three, at the time, I had three kids, and that I was a single father. I just started, you know, dating my fiance, and we had, when I got the job, I did have a kid. So it was just during that time when that occurred. So there were four kids, and I'm taking care of this family, and the union was absolutely corrupt. Like, they would not protect you. Like, literally, they almost let me get fired because I took paternity leave when I had a baby at home because I was going to be gone more than a few days, even though I notified all my bosses, did everything. Luckily, I learned all the rules. I actually got offered a job as a union advocate because I got everyone in the mill at the top to shy back and leave me alone, and I won on my own because the advocates couldn't even stand up to them. And they were like, dude, if you're going to stand up to them, why don't you do this? And I'm like, well, I've been doing this dumb job I have covering their butts for so long that I realize that they don't even know they're pushing the red button, what that means. Like, they don't even get the damage they're causing. And
yeah,
that's what I see. And when I was in the military, that again, because there's such degree of separation from the action to the reaction, you know, to the result of said action. And it's in every aspect of our lives, corporate being the worst because that's not my job. I don't know anything about that. You know, that's Sue's job. Sue's supposed to push that paper through. And it's at that point, it's a signature and a form or an email or a memo. And next thing you know, there's a guy jumping off a bridge because you just ruined his entire life and he lost his family or whatever because somebody was like, we need to save 3 cents over here. And that guy saving 3 cents is like, I can't wait to go see my daughter play basketball. I'm so proud of her. I love going to church. Man, you know, I just, you know, like, it's a normal guy doing a normal job that's disconnected from the results of his actions. I see these cops. I see military. They're all doing it. And it's like, what happened?
You guys have set me up so great for my next comment because you were talking about toolboxes, Ruthanne, and you're talking about top-down solutions. And this has been my obsession is systems. I was trained in systems analysis. And what it is it's like this. We have one solution as a larger society for every problem, and that is a top-down hierarchical solution. We're constantly waiting for somebody at the top to make the decision that filters down through some kind of hierarchy to get something done. That's causing that separation. And what I studied systems, what I felt like was that was a toolbox, and you open the toolbox, and there's only one tool in it, and that's a hammer. Well, if you only have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail that you have to hit, right? In other words, we've got a corporate, hierarchical, top-down society. When we started out this conversation beautifully talking about what can I do, because if I just sit around and I'm just helpless and I've got learned helplessness as a consumer and I just buy, whatever, and then I lose my job and I don't know how to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a disempowered person who was plugged into a system, a system like you talked about, the normal corporate whatever, top-down solution system, has now become separate from that. What do? Well, there's an underlying system. Underlying all of our corporate systems is an implicate order. It's the ways that our grandmothers and grandfathers did. There's a living off the land and making your own way. And for a while, you can swim around in that feeling of helplessness. And, you know, I had the experience of, you know, I have very few jobs I can do. I'm injured. You know, I'm disabled from taking care of this person. I'm trying to get jobs, and it's just not working. I tried to start a business. That was not working because there's no support for entrepreneurial types of things because of the credit being unavailable. So I ended up kind of thinking about my life and starting with me. What can I do? Well, that system is called is a holarchic system or holons, and that's a whole interesting area of study where you think of the entire system is made up of parts, and each part is capable in and of itself. And there are people pressing for the concept of instead of making you an isolated part like a car part, and you're tossed out and you're done, and you're not part of this machine over here. You are a part of nature. You're a human being. You're in a family. You're in a community. You start thinking of yourself as a complete and part yourself, and that's what's called a holon. A holon is like a hologram. It's complete in and of itself, but it's part of something. So if it's part of an ecosystem, it's like the fish that's all the school of fish. Each fish is a holon of the school of fish and part of their ecology. So that's a kind of a really deep philosophical space that you start with on permaculture. If permaculture is starting to return to thinking of systems of our life, and we're all connected to systems whether we know it or not or aware of it or not, is rethink your systems from the bottom up or from me out instead of from top down. Because we're all waiting for the top down, and I'm telling you, looking at this economic thing, we're kind of left to our own devices here. And that's not a bad thing because actually we're very capable beings, right? So that's mm-hmm. that flip is stop thinking of top-down solutions because you're just going to sit there and wait for them to try to fix this thing that's mingled beyond all recognition called the economy as we used to know it. It's failing, you know, and it's collapsing, but collapse is a process. It's like if you want to build a house, you're probably going to have to collapse the old icky barn that was there and get rid of everything and build something else. But when you go for that building, go for permanence, go for abundance, go for we have so many people with so many talents sitting on the shelf and twiddling their thumbs and they have nothing to do who have tremendous talent. I had a bus driver in Olympia who was a nuclear physicist. I mean, this guy could probably help with the whole new energy paradigm, and you know, he's driving a bus because he ran afoul of the system, the powers that be in his field, and got, you know, blackballed and a bunch of hierarchy bullshit that went on. And so he's driving a bus, right? It's like we have so many talented people with degrees, with knowledge, with abilities, who had businesses. I used to have a business. I was successful. Who are just, you know, spinning their wheels because society now no longer knows how to integrate them into society. Unless you can make coffee at Starbucks, you can't really integrate back into that machine. Right?
It's very true. It's dead on.
You guys set me up good. Thanks.
By the way, that link, that was amazing. And the whole time I'm watching that, with them talking, explaining that, I was thinking, this is insane. It'll never work. You know, I'm still in that mindset of, like, you need bosses. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm designing a company with partners where we're doing that. We're thinking that way. And I'm like, who influenced us to do it? And I'm like, a lot, like Google, Apple, you know, like people are like, we want free thinkers back on the planet and in the system. Now, they are still, you know, a corporate thing, but you can't switch it all overnight. You can only integrate transitions, you know, and like we've been talking about. And it just, the whole thing, like, that was such a good inspirational moment because it forced me to really stop and look. It's why the cock thing came up, because I'm just so like, what am I doing wrong with my approach to looking for solutions? Like, what can I do at my level? And then what can I do to share with people, which created an awesome, really, you know, heavy argument with, a friend of mine from the mill who just, he can't handle me disagreeing with him. And I'm saying this very thing, you know, what I've been saying, like, they're people. Yeah, there's a lot of violence, but they're people. Like, there's got to be a break in there somewhere where you go, wait a minute. The perpetrators of the damage, once aware, like, when you're beating up somebody, you're not a cop anymore. Like, that's a problem. But there's cops out there, and there's firemen, and there's union officials, and there's politicians who are there because they love doing the right thing. And they're more than the ones that don't. But the problem is the corruption, it's at a level where you feel powerless. And one thing society has done is everything's so, you know, the Tower of Babel, all the tribes are speaking different languages. Now we can't connect. We're disconnected from each other so far now that when I see a guy in trouble, I'm ultimately already going to think he's at fault. I'm not going to take a risk. I'm not going to be, you know, the Snowden and stand up for America as a standard person in this country, especially, because I don't know what I can do to protect that person. I don't know the power I have as a group, as a village, as a city, as a country, you know? So we just let the bullies bully because we're like, well, that's just the way it is. Or they're corrupt. And then cuss at them, yell at them, hate them as a them, quote, unquote. And not, hey, that's Joe from down the street. Now, that dude just helped me fix my plumbing. There's no way in hell that guy's that bad. What's going on, you know? And even the people doing the violence, you know, even the real awful perpetrations and stuff, maybe that guy's mentally unstable. Maybe he just caught his wife sleeping with his best friend and he's at work now, can't handle it because his kid has autism and his wife left him for, you know, somebody else and blah, blah, blah. And he's going to end up getting in a fight. And then he has this crazy woman that he has no clue she's crazy, commits crime, can't be subdued, and he loses his shit and totally ruins his job and does something absolutely wrong. And then the police force then is like, we got to protect our own because that's what the bosses say you do. That's what football teams say they do when they gang rape girls, you know. This is what you do. I know that from being in the Army and being in construction. You protect your own. I lived my life doing that until recently. And then I realized I can stand up to people. And I made a real mess of my social life at the mill because of that. At the end of my term, I had a lot more friends than when I got in there because I didn't take shit from people. Because I realized I'm a person. I got power to stand up to you. You're just a person, even if you hold my job at stake. And not everybody can do that because not everybody's been told they can. Yeah. And one reason why I loved Occupy because it was a bunch of people finally going, screw this. We're going to yell. Yeah, it didn't accomplish much, but it sure as hell got attention, and people started noticing.
Because it taught people empowerment.
Thank you. Okay, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. I got to watch my language with this. You're right. It accomplished something different than expected.
Exactly.
People thought that the world would change, and they didn't realize what change looks like. But yet, what do you see right now? Yeah, everything is in any spiritual quest. In any movement, it's always darkest before the dawn. So I post this, like, for instance, this article about a cop, someone I pay taxes to protect me, beating up a woman on the street because he can't subdue her. A woman, one, and then two, she's mentally handicapped. So she's less strong than him in two ways. And he beat her with his fist. He did not use the force he was taught to use to subdue her. He beat her with his fist. Well, okay, so now you got all this stuff, and it's like, if that was not, if that was like, say, 5 years ago before Occupy, that article wouldn't be out there right now. What did Occupy do? It let people know they had a voice, and that that voice was not regulated by the government, that they had media. Yeah, Facebook's, you know, the devil, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? Just like the Internet, just like any survivalist creature, anything that, you know, evolves to survive, in basic Darwinism here, we find a way to evolve. And right now, it's a mental, spiritual evolution. It is not meat and potatoes now. It's not about us getting, you know, longer arms, larger heads. We're getting mentally evolved. We're growing and realizing that our system is eating itself up. It's flawed. And now we're like, oh, shit, what do we do? Well, now we have to peel all the scabs back. We got to look at the damage we did. Like in any spiritual journey, the first thing you do is look at the ugliness and point it out. Because you have to analyze it. You got to study it. You got to know why it's there so you don't let it happen again or so you can avoid putting yourself in a spot where you do it to yourself or whatever. And so, like, all this ugliness, all this shit we're talking about, the economy is collapsing, and they're still doing their mothballing cars and houses. Cops are beating people up. Well, it's all this ugly crap that we've always had, and now it's coming to surface in such full force because it's the evolutionary step, you know? It is the, okay, here's the dark part. The dawn is when these conversations we're having, when that's the standard thought
yes.
with everybody. Everyone's like, this
okay.
is what you do. Because don't you feel like we're looking at a mountain right now like I do? Like, we're talking about this, and I watched that video that guy talking about. I'm like, there's no way people will do this. And I'm like, well, that's exactly why we're still here, doing the same thing on the treadmill, because we all say that.
Yeah.
Stop being no people. Start being yes. Say yes. I'll figure it out. And then as a whole, as society, we go, yes, we'll figure it out. And one of the biggest things that we've all caught on is that we're all, first off, not communicating as a whole. We're separate. You know, like, Karen, you get real good at darning socks, and I'm really good at, something great, you know, and that you can use. And so we find that barter zone. You don't need to solve it in this conversation, because then you're just going back to having yourself regulated by something.
Yeah.
That's communication with the people. We don't need to develop a system and hand the booklet out. We need to develop a form of thinking and let people think for themselves and sort it out for themselves like we used to. We did. Villages were fine until we went in and fucked them up and said, you need governors, you need this and that. You need to, stop wearing gourds on your penises. Wear this bikini brief, you know. And honestly, the gourd works great. It keeps ticks out of your dick hole, you know. I mean, like, why do I need the bikini briefs? But we're very arrogant people. And we walk in and we do these, you know, and all for good. We're still pushing that button because it keeps my family fed. So what if I'm, you know, right now I have no clue I'm killing little Jewish children in a gas chamber. I'm keeping my family happy, which is the job of a dad, you know? And it's the same thing. When we go out there, I'm sure the vaccination thing with Bill Gates, you know, like, he's probably got great intentions. He probably means well. I think he's batshit crazy. But I'm sure he means well, you know? And you can't fault people for that. You can only fault the accessibility of ignorance, the fact that it's condoned, the fact that we shoot down, say no to everything. We don't stop and go, wait a minute, I'm going to step back, I'm going to look at this differently, and I'm going to come back to it. And maybe, just maybe, it might work, you know? And maybe I missed something because I'm looking at it from my perspective, my experience. And we're not taught that. That's called being thinking out of the box. That's being creative. That's, you know, that's crazy. We can't do that anymore, you know, and here we are. We're talking about it. And
well,
I don't know.
I don't think we should be afraid of collapse necessarily either, because one project I worked on, we needed bricks for the artesian well project I was working on, and suddenly someone said, well, there's this warehouse that has these bricks that were basically from the 1964 earthquake in the town, and a building collapsed. And
you know what?
Were,
you just hit it on the head.
Yeah, no,
In other words,
okay, collapse is kind of a situation where the stuff that was not sustainable falls apart. Now, you do have all the separation of all the pieces, including us. We're all sitting back being potential pieces for something new. And now we're going to sit and, you know, mutually architect an idea. And suddenly we had these beautiful bricks that went into this project that was a part of the past of this town's history, but became part of a new facility
mm-hmm.
that was there that saved, you know, at the time that this facility was being built, that, you know, was one of the worst economic times for the city. So they've got to find solutions. They can't do it the old way where they got a bond and got millions of dollars to do this project. You know, it had a pretty
mm-hmm.
small budget, and there we were able to use something legacy that the community wisdom, someone knew was there and available. So, I mean,
yeah.
the collapse part is scary. Like, oh, collapse, we're all running in the streets. Well, okay, are we really? I don't know. I think the collapse is really slow, frankly. I think it's been going on a while, and we're, some of us have now had time to think of some ideas and solutions, but it starts with self-empowerment. Somebody, I had a conversation about self-empowerment this week, is get over your learned helpless. Okay, you don't know how to do something. Well, if you don't know how to do something and you want it bad enough, what do? You go learn. And you go apply yourself and you figure something out. And Ruthie, and I love your idea of writing your skills down. I know for me, I'm not able to do the me too. That's a real good self-esteem builder for someone who maybe feels really helpless or really defeated or really has had, you know, negative experiences with maybe their work or their house is being foreclosed
and
or whatever. Make that list.
Even if your self-esteem isn't really down, I mean, sure, this is going to build it up, but also it's going to remind you of things that you maybe it just took for granted. You didn't even, you know, I mean, you can go about it any kind of a way. I mean, you can just start out with things maybe that you were taught, and then things that you taught yourself, things that pertain to your house, things that pertain to your transportation. I mean, you can take it in all kinds of segments and just say, how much, okay, I know how to drive. Okay, I also know how to change the oil. You know, I mean, things that you don't, you know, it just reminds you of how many things you do have in your toolbox or tool chest.
I'm so doing
that. The fact that you said you know how to drive, like, that's the thing, too, is we're very prone to judging. And the first thing in my head when you said that was, that's a useless thing to throw down. Everybody knows how to drive. And then I'm like, wait a minute. That's exactly why the U.S. is in the state it's in. Because I follow what I was raised to do, and everyone else here is, you need to be negative. Well, no, you don't. You need to look at everything as valuable. Everything is valuable.
Exactly.
I love this, because it totally, I could, like, you, and the first thing you're going to look at is, well, what are the puzzle pieces I'm missing? How do I fit them? Maybe it isn't me. Maybe it's someone I can bring in, or someone that I'm already, you know, around, and, like, you start looking at those assets, and, like, you know, I think you're right. Like, the collapse, I heard some talk from a guy who was hanging out with a probabilities expert who studies our economy and social constructs, and they're basically saying that water and food, due to the money falling apart, they're looking at it in 2 years. The guy gave it 22 months. He said that the people who are not able to produce these things at a cheap level, company-wise, he's looking at the economy, the corporate stuff, the companies that can't produce the standard needs of people at a cheap, sustainable level are going to fall under, because they won't have the influx of cash to stay alive. Like you were talking about, like, it's already happening. You know, the cars are mothballed, houses are mothballed. Right. By default of their greed alone, and it's a machine greed, you know, there's probably a few people up at the top, but they're not aware of the damage they're even doing, you know. It's kind of, it's a very convoluted thing.
Over. Yeah, the machine.
Exactly.
Rolling.
And it's going to break down. And this thing, you know, the way he was talking, it kind of got me concerned. And I'm like, wait a minute, the business I'm in, this is what I do. And I'm like, that would actually place us in a good spot, because we've been focused on cheap, sustainable versions and make it accessible to everybody with the intention of being ready for money not to be there. And it was like, I know I'm not alone in this, because I talked to a ton of people doing similar stuff. So I'm not so scared of that collapse, quote unquote, you know, like the preppers, you know, have your bug out bag. And, like, I've always felt odd about getting extreme with prepping. And I realized, well, in an emergency, can you survive or keep your family alive with whatever's in your pocket? And so, therefore, know your region you're in, know what's going on there, know how to survive in that region in any climate, you know, if it's winter or summer, and know where the resources are wherever you go when you put time into something. And other than that, you really can't really be prepared, because you have no clue what's going on. You can't store your basement full of 3 years of food and be ready, because more than likely it's just energy spent in the wrong direction when you should have known, like you were saying, like you should know how to forage. You should know, like, tell me a Native American 1,000 years ago that kept a basement full of canned goods.
No. Right. Exactly.
We don't need that shit.
I want to give everybody a resource. Findaspring.com. Get on findaspring.com and find out where there's springs in your area where you can get water. Believe it or not,
I'm 5 minutes from one. I totally did it.
Know where those are, right?
I did it, yeah.
That's good.
I did that right when we moved there. It's actually tied to the whole research of my land and stuff and all the weirdness that's there. But it was because of that. You have to. You should know these things. You know, like, for instance, I think we talked about this when the power went out in New York. And within, what, a day, people were out of water in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
They couldn't flush toilets. They couldn't drink. They had pop. People were going, they were going to the hospital because they were dehydrated.
Yeah.
Because they had tap water, and they just assumed it always would be there. You know, and then I was, someone mentioned to me in Canada, crazy thing, in Canada, they're not allowed to turn your utilities off if you can't pay the bill. You know that? In Canada, if you, they are obligated, those things, which our government does not feel obligated anymore. Our corporations is really what they are, don't feel obligated to keep you resourced. Your power and your gas and your water can never be turned off if you can't pay the bill. That is
actually
a law in Canada.
Okay. Yeah, isn't that, I mean, and it should be the law. Yeah.
It should be. It should be. Well, in a resource-based, you know, holistic economy where everybody has the core survival needs, provisions, I like using that, you know, the core provisions in a community, those should be supplied. And that's some people do earnestly feel that way in America. That is a common thought. And yet our higher-ups will adamantly state that that is not, they say, oh, yeah, we're with you, but it never occurs because it's tied to that corporate monster. But once again, as we've just pointed out, that is dying in slow chunks. But, you know, bankers are tossing themselves off of bridges and cars are being mothballed and houses are mothballed and things are collapsing and patents are getting open source, like, you know, the Tesla car and stuff like that. Like, things are moving in that direction, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, the terraformer, you know, like Angel brought up, like, that's one of those things I was just talking about. Like, that stuff is going out in the right direction, and there's no fighting it. And I could blame Occupy all day for that, because that was, common people were not aware of the pit that they were sitting in because football was on, you know? And now
I want to tell you what happened after Occupy. Somehow or another, it happened that the people who were involved in the Occupy movement had a post-Occupy meeting actually in Olympia, where I was living at the time, Olympia, Washington.
Nice.
And I actually got to meet quite a few people from all over the world. I mean, it was an incredible experience. And so it was kind of like, what can we build on from the ideas, because what would happen at Occupy was a tremendous amount of discussion about all of our systems, about our banking system, about our corporate system. That was what actually was happening at the meetings. I couldn't attend very many of them because my, like, general assemblies and whatnot, my mother was ill, but I went down a few times, and there was, that was what the conversations they were having finally about that. And then, of course, it was, you know, ended. And then, you know, in our case, it was shut down. I really was upset with how they ended it in Olympia because we were opening. We had our grand opening of the Artesian well after the city bought it, and we were very celebratory and happy. Some of us activists just to find out that they closed the Occupy camp the same day, and it was really frustrating. But a few months later, they had this follow-up meeting, and that was what could we build. And so the kinds of things I heard at this follow-up meeting were, how can we create business co-ops where the employees own the business together? How can we how can we learn more about our systems of how we get our food? How can we support our local food producers? How can we, mm-hmm. you know, I love that, because the people didn't just say, oh, well, Occupy's over, that was a fun festival, I guess we'll just go back to the way things. There was this real sense of people going, no, you know what, this was really meaningful to me. I don't quite know what it was all about, but what can I, it really connected a lot of people to each other in my community who had never worked together before to do activities. So, you know, there was an echo. There was an echo from that event for people to think about community systems.
Oh, there's that damn music.
That music. We will be back next week. We're going to do this one again, right?
So yeah, this one's so thick. Cool. All right.
Bye-bye.
I'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye. Bye-bye.